Okay, so last time we basically did this broad brushed overview of cosmology in the homogeneous limit, right? So we saw the, for the umpteenth time probably, the FRW metric and in the flat case, which is primarily what we'll be interested in, that looks something like this. In terms of the proper time, and then we also defined the conformal time. Where tau is just equal to the integral of 1 over a with respect to t. Okay, so that was the Friedmann equation. We wrote down the law of conservation of energy momentum, and that told us that for a perfect fluid, if I take the nu equals zero component, then I get some differential equation for rho, which was the time derivative of rho over rho is given by three minus three, one plus w times the time derivative of a over a. And from this, we integrated it and learned that rho can be written as some constant times a to the minus 3 times 1 plus w. Okay, so that was sort of half of the job. So that's how the sources behave. But now we can stick this ansatz for the sources into Einstein's equation. So. So we can stick the metric and t mu nu for a perfect fluid into Einstein. And that, of course, gives the Friedmann equations, which I presume you have seen before. And the Friedmann equations, we usually define something called the Hubble parameter. That's H, which is just the time derivative of A over A squared. And this is equal to 8 pi G Newton over 3. Times the sum over all the individual components of the density. And if I happen to have curvature around, then I would stick on here negative kappa over a squared. So that's the first Friedmann equation. That's the standard one. So you can see that H is pretty much just related to the densities that are around. So that's the first Friedmann equation. There's also another one, which tells me about the second time derivatives of the scale factor. So this second Friedmann equation says that the second time derivative of A over A is negative 4 pi G Newton over 3 times a sum of rho plus 3p. And I can use the equation of state parameter to rewrite that as negative 4 pi G Newton over 3, sum rho I 1 plus 3 W, where W could be different for the individual components. Okay. So this is the set of equations that we need to figure out how the scale factor evolves for some given set of fluids, okay, the different fluids being described by the density. And by sticking in this functional form for the density, then it's possible to integrate these equations and figure out, say, how A depends on time. So just a few general comments. So this second Friedmann equation tells us about accelerated expansion. And you'll notice here that from this expression, a double dot, or the second derivative of a, is going to be negative unless this sum here is negative as well. Okay, so I need for accelerated expansion, so for the second time derivative of a to be greater than zero, you can see from this here, we need some fluid that has w less than minus a third. So if w is negative one third, then I get a double dot equals zero. W is less than minus one third, then I can get a double dot bigger than zero. So I need some fluid which has an equation of state parameter that's less than negative one third. So we'll just contrast that with the things that we know and love. There's matter. For matter, W is zero. For radiation, W is a third. So a universe filled with only matter and radiation is doomed to always decelerate. And you can think about that as just the fact that if I have a bunch of matter lying around in my universe, I could blow it apart by causing the universe to initially expand, but eventually the gravitational attraction of all of that matter and radiation is forceful enough to bring everything back together. So I will always be decelerating. I don't necessarily have to crunch. To crunch, you actually need a positive curvature, but that's a drag. That's a drag on the expansion, that attraction between the matter and radiation in the universe. So on the cusp, you can define a sort of curvature density. So I could just take this term here, and I could rewrite it as 8 pi g Newton over 3 times rho curvature, where now this thing that I call rho curvature is just an energy density that dilutes like 1 over a squared. So if I have a density that goes like 1 over a squared, you can see that in order to make that work, I need to make this thing in here w negative 1 third. So if w is minus 1 third, I get 1 minus 1 third, that's 2 thirds, and negative 3 times 2 thirds is negative 2, right? So I get a to the minus 2. So for curvature, w is minus 1 third. So a universe that's dominated by curvature actually doesn't accelerate. A double dot is 0. And then lambda, cosmological constant, has w of minus 1, and so you can see why lambda accomplishes the feat of making an accelerating universe. That just comes from this equation here. Yeah. Okay, so this will be important. Of course, inflation is a period of exponential expansion, so now you know what you need to make inflation happen. Basically, you need a fluid with W less than minus a third. So a nice way to look at the Friedmann equations is in terms of an energy budget. Okay, so before we discuss this, let's just set out a few conventions. So our convention will be that the scale factor today in our universe is 1. So A will say at T naught equals 1. And that's just a convention. You could set the scale factor to be whatever you want today. It's just convenient to set it to 1. So we'll do that. The other convention is that the Hubble parameter today we'll call it H naught, and we're going to give it some kind of funny units. So this is 100 H kilometers per second times megaparsecs. So this is the Hubble parameter day today. That tells us something about how fast the scale factor is changing today, where H is a constant. So this is basically we've stuffed all the functional dependence, the different dependence this could have on the various cosmologies into this constant. And it's equal to about 0.67 from Planck. This is measured in a number of different ways. There's actually somewhat of a controversy right now about what the correct value to use for H naught should be. Because if I measure it using different methods, I get different answers, some of which agree, some of which don't agree. And that could either be systematics or some real discrepancy describing interesting physics. That's kind of up in the air right now. But that's a fiducial value you can take. It's about 0.67. And H naught, so this is a kind of, you can think of a measure of cosmological distance, time, and energy scales today. So it's useful to convert this number using the speed of light into times and distances. And so H naught is 1 over 14.6 billion years, expressed in terms of time. H naught is 1 over 4,500 megaparsecs, expressed in distance. And it's about 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, expressed in terms of energy. So these are useful numbers to have kicking around in the back of your head. This is, you can think of basically roughly the size of the universe. This is roughly the age of the universe. And this is roughly the energy scale that characterizes the universe today, say the cosmological constant, because that's what's beginning to dominate the energy density of the universe today. So these are just good numbers to have in the back of your head. And this parameterization is just total convention, but it's what everyone uses, so you should know. So the CMB is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So if we were to convert Kelvin to electron volts, please don't quote me on this. But I believe that's something like 10 to the minus 1 or 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. So this is far, far smaller than the energy in the CMB. But I can't remember Boltzmann's constant off the top of my head, so you should look that up. Okay, so good. So with those conventions, we can now rewrite our Friedmann equation up there. Let's just divide by H naught squared. So we'll divide both sides by H naught squared. And when I do so, and I substitute in that expression there for rho, then I can rewrite my Friedmann equation as the sum over some different set of components over a to the minus 3, 1 plus wi. Okay, so that today, with this parameterization, first of all, what do I mean by this? So these omega i's are just 8 pi g Newton rho naught for each component over 3 times h naught squared. Okay, so that's just taking the right-hand side of the Friedmann equation and dividing by h naught. Nothing fancier than that. And the kind of nice thing about this definition is that today we get 1 on the left-hand side and a equals 1 on the right-hand side. So this is just a sum over these individual components. So you can think of these omegas as parameterizing the fraction of the energy density
over a non-minus.
That's right. Thanks, Dan. Okay, so these omega i's are just an expression of the energy, the fraction of the energy density in different components. Okay. Yep.
What's the difference between the omegas, let's say,
that's defined as rho over rho critical?
So it's not, exactly, because this thing here is what we call rho critical. Yeah, the critical density. 1 over rho critical. Yeah, it includes curvature. So let's write out the different components that might live in here before we go on. So in general, what do we have in the universe? We've got radiation. So that goes like 1 over 8 to the fourth. We've got cold dark matter, and we've got baryons. And those both act like matter. And often we call rho cold dark or omega cold dark matter plus omega baryon omega matter, just the total amount of matter. As you point out, there is also curvature, which we'll just write as something that has some energy density, right? So we've just associated our initial density here with the parameter kappa we had up top, and then divided that by the critical density, and we're going to call that omega curvature. And then finally, maybe I have some dark energy. So in general, this is going to be the sort of ingredients that we consider: radiation, matter, curvature, and lambda, although curvature not so much. And these have the nice property that these things, so I should just say notes, the omega i's are the fractional density today. Why is that? Because I could have here just divided by h, right, and gotten a critical density that depends on time as well. This is just going to be our convention. Okay, so these omega i's are the fractional densities today. And this, of course, allows us to draw the cosmic pie chart that you've probably seen about 10,000 times, where now we actually can describe what these different pieces mean. Okay. So omega lambda is literally just the fractional energy density. And we know from Planck that omega lambda is about 0.684. So that's about 68.4% is in dark energy. Here we have omega c. Omega c is about 0.2, or omega matter, excuse me, 0.26, or no, omega c, that's actually what I meant, 0.267. So that's about 26.7%. And then in here we've got omega b, that's about 0.049, so about 4.9%. And then somewhere in here, some tiny, tiny little piece of this pie, we've got omega radiation, and that's about 10 to the minus 5. So that doesn't even show up on the pie. Yeah, so I don't think I could quote you in a value for omega k, but it's certainly smaller. Yeah, can I? Actually, I can. Yeah, so omega k, I believe, if you look at Planck, has got to be less than about 10 to the minus 2, maybe a little bit less than that, something between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3. If it's not already 10 to the minus 3, I know that we're going to get here pretty soon with large-scale structure observations of baryon acoustic oscillation. So you can think it's somewhere in this range. So the bound on omega k is bigger than the bound on omega r. So you might ask, well, how the hell do I know that omega r is 10 to the minus 5? And that just comes from considering the energy density. We know the temperature of the CMB because we measure its spectrum. Most of the photons, most of this radiation is CMB. And this is just calculated from rho for photons at a temperature of about 2.73 degrees Kelvin. OK, Okay, so I just look at the formula for the energy density of a relativistic gas of a certain temperature, and then I calculate the density, divide it by the critical density today, and then the answer you get is about 10 to the minus 5. So that's not actually directly measured.
Based on the measurement of a double dot.
So we don't. That's not the best way to do it. The best way to look for omega k is to look for deviations from Euclidean geometry. So null paths, light rays in an open universe or a closed universe travel differently. So you'd actually get a distortion of the angular scale of different objects that you look at. So what you need is a standard ruler. So if I have something of known size and I compute the observed apparent angular scale, then that will be different if I'm in an open, closed, or flat universe. So just as a brief aside, let's say I have a standard ruler of length L, and I have some observer here who's looking out at this thing, right? So this thing subtends some scale theta, say, and let's say I know the distance that it was away. Then in Euclidean geometry, I know roughly what the correlation between this angular scale and these different lengths are. So I know that theta should be roughly equal to d over L. But if it's an open or closed universe, then that won't hold true. So then photons don't travel on these straight paths. Instead, what would happen is something like this, or something like this. And so I'd have a different angular scale. And that's really the way that you fix omega curvature. And the standard ruler that we have, so we'll just say that standard rulers are used to measure omega k. And the best one is what is known as the baryon acoustic oscillations, which we will discuss in detail, but just as a preview, you can think of this as sort of the wavelength of sound waves in the early universe, in the primordial plasma. Yeah?
So is there an effect of this omega k that we should consider? Is there a certain distance? So for example, if I wanted to measure the diameter of some distant superstructure, mm-hmm. when do I really have to consider the effect of this omega k?
Good question. So in general, if it were large, the answer would be always. But we can get an idea of when it's important to measure it by looking at, again, this function, this plot of rho versus t. So we had radiation that went like a to the minus 4. We had matter that went like a to the minus 3. And now let's say we had curvature in the universe, right? So curvature falls off even more slowly. Curvature goes like 1 over a squared. So you can see that at later and later times, curvature becomes more and more important. Okay. So roughly speaking, the effects of the curvature, the fact that we have this non-Euclidean geometry, is more important actually for closer structures than farther structures, because curvature becomes a more important component of the energy density of the universe. So you can see it all over the place. I mean, it's a little bit hard to say, first of all, because if I want to look at the path of these photons, it's actually an integral. So there's different, you know, as I go out farther, the geometry gets more and more Euclidean in a sense, right? And then it just kind of gets adjusted close to me. So, you know, the primary tool is actually the CMB. So if I consider the CMB, then I'm talking about a redshift of like 1,000, right? Now, where on the photon's path does it get the most correction? That might be, as you said, of z of order 1, where this effect becomes more important. Of course, there's a problem, which is we also have a cosmological constant. So there's actually an issue here, which is where does that floor set in, right? If that floor sets in, well, we know it sets in before curvature dominates, because if curvature dominated the energy density, omega curvature would be order 1, and it would be totally obvious that we lived in that universe. So the real universe probably looks a little bit more like this. So curvature never gets a chance to dominate, and in fact it's about 1,100 or 1,000 times smaller in terms of energy density than lambda today. So it's buried in there. I guess long story short, when do you need to calculate it? When do you need to use it? Kind of always. It's always in there to some extent. But we kind of know from just empirically from data that it's a pretty small effect if you include it. Go ahead.
Physically to have an energy density due to curvature? Something's bent, therefore it has an energy density.
It doesn't really mean anything, honestly. I mean, it's just a way of parameterizing it in a convenient way so that I can write the flat universe Robertson-Walker flat universe Friedman equation and include curvature in a convenient way.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's no real physical energy density associated with curvature. It's a geometrical effect. Any other questions?
Sorry. Based on the measures, do they know if there's that k is guaranteed to be greater or less than 2?
No, not yet. So I wish I remembered the error bars. but if you look at it, the central value and the error bars incorporate both positive and negative values. So at this point, it's consistent with 0.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, that was good. As I said, we'll have more to say about this later, so stay tuned. So here's the cosmic pi, and the cosmic pi gives us a standard model of cosmology, which you've probably heard before. So the standard model of cosmology, lambda CDM, is creatively named after the main constituents of this pi. Lambda just means cosmological constant, and CDM means cold, dark matter. Okay, so the pi tells me that most of the universe is lambda and dark matter, and the cold part, well, that's a little bit extra. And I guess you'll learn about that in your explorations in particle physics class, because apparently it's all about dark matter. But cold just means that it's non-relativistic. So it's made of non-relativistic particles. Actually, I guess you do get that, because we assume that it goes like 1 over a cubed. So it must be cold. So anyway, that's the model, just to name it, the standard cosmological model, lambda CDM. So there's a few other interesting things that we can learn from writing the Friedman equation in this form. So there's a time when these density curves cross, if we go back here. So if I look here, there's some time when the energy density in matter and the energy density in radiation become equal. And we can express that in terms of these omegas. So we just want to see when omega radiation over a to the fourth and omega matter over a cubed are equal. And this defines the scale factor at this time of matter radiation equality. So here we can just solve this. And a at matter radiation equality is just going to be omega radiation over omega matter. And if we use the numbers that we had in this pie chart, then this is something like 1 over 3,000. So it's about 10 to the minus 4. Okay. Another thing we can look at is when the cosmological constant starts to dominate the energy density of the universe. So we could look at the time when matter is equal to the energy density in dark energy or cosmological constant, lambda. So solving that, we would see that the time or the scale factor at which lambda begins to dominate the energy density of the universe is omega matter or over omega dark energy to the 1/3 power. And that, if you stick in the numbers from the cosmic pi, is something like 0.78. So fairly recently, if the scale factor today is 1. Now, a much more convenient way of thinking about the scale factor is to turn it into something physical, something that we actually observe, and that is a redshift of photons. So the redshift is just defined as if I have some distant galaxy or something sending me photons, it emits radiation with a certain wavelength, and I receive that radiation with potentially a different wavelength because the universe is expanding. Then the redshift is just the fractional change in the wavelength. And of course, because lambda observed is just lambda emitted over A, so I just take the wavelength and I stretch it by the scale factor, and that's what I would see, then that implies that the redshift Z is just 1 over 1 plus A. So I can turn these quantities here into redshifts, and that's a much more convenient way of thinking about things. So for example, Z at matter radiation equality is roughly 1 over 1 plus 1 over 3,000, and that's about, if you want me to be more precise, about 3,402. The redshift of this lambda domination is about 0.28, and the redshift today is 0. That's not right. It's 1 over 1 minus A. No, it's A is 1 over 1 plus Z, so that means that, sorry about that, guys. Failure of basic algebra. So 1 plus Z is 1 over A, and that means Z is 1 over A minus 1. Excuse the mistake. Okay, so the redshift today is 0. Here's some convenient set of numbers. In the notes, I have some other redshifts that sort of correspond to numbers you should have in the back of your mind. Another fairly important one for us will be the redshift at recombination, and that's about 1090. So that's the formation of the CMB. Okay, so these are just useful numbers to have in mind. So I think that's about all I wanted to say about the Robertson-Walker universe, the smooth background. Are there any questions about that before we move on to screwing it up and sticking fluctuations in it? So the next thing on our list to discuss are perturbations. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to take our Robertson-Walker universe . So let's say I have some time slice here And then I have some later time slice here. I'm just going to paint on it. I'm going to paint little splotches, my own Jackson Pollock painting and going on here of these various shapes. And these shapes will do nothing to my background. They will just live on it, okay? And that's going to be our theory. We are going to discuss the theory of painting splotches on our Robertson-Walker universe. So we're going to look at small fluctuations that simply paint the background. So when is this valid? Well, if I am Jackson Pollock and I really like to stick a lot of paint on my canvas, eventually I will stick enough paint on my canvas that it starts to bend. And of course, then my approximation that it's just not affecting it is not right anymore. Okay. So to the extent that this is true, that I can neglect back reaction, you can basically do linear theory. That's really what I mean by linear theory. Whenever I can discuss things happening on a stage that I've set up and it doesn't affect the properties of the stage, I'm in the linear regime. And that's what we will do. Now, what kind of laws are going to govern my Jackson Pollock painting? So that sort of depends on what scales I'm looking at. So I know that in general relativity, as long as I look at small enough distance scales and small enough time scales, I can always describe it by a flat space. I can always describe it by Minkowski space, right? So as long as I look, zoom in far enough into this little patch here, this will be just Newtonian physics in flat space. If I want to talk about really large scales, on the other hand, then I need GR. So we're going to start by looking at this theory here, just the theory of Newtonian physics in flat space, to gain some intuition about how the perturbations in this background universe behave. Okay, and you'll explore that in your tutorial in great detail. I'll just kind of give you an outline right now. So on small enough length and time scales, I can just look at Newtonian mechanics in flat space. So if I have a set of fluids, then the laws that govern their evolution include the following. So I have the statement of conservation of mass. That's the continuity equation. I have the equivalent of Newton's second law, which is the Euler equation, and that's given by this. So this quantity here, to sort of translate that into what we had before, start a table here, variables. So there's rho, there's p, that's just as we had before for perfect fluids. In the relativistic case, we had a four velocity, and that, of course, you can write as a time component and a three velocity. And it's that three velocity that appears in these equations, right? Because it's just Newtonian mechanics, it's non-relativistic, so I can forget about the fact that velocity is a four vector, it's just the three velocity. Okay, so I've got the continuity equation, that's the conservation law, I've got the Euler equation, that's the force law, and then finally I have the law of gravity, which is just the Poisson equation. So that's del squared phi is 4 pi g Newton times rho. And then, of course, I need an equation that relates the pressure to the density. So I need the equation of state. Okay, and this is a sufficient set of laws and variables to describe my fluid in the presence of gravity. So what do we do with it? Oh, by the way, this thing phi, actually I should just put a little star here. Yesterday I told you that you can write your metric in an almost Robertson-Walker universe as the following. And that phi, you just identify with the Newtonian potential in the non-relativistic limit. Okay. So this phi I have in my Poisson equation, you can identify in the non-relativistic limit as that metric function there. Okay, so what to do? Those equations are deceptively simple. It's if you've ever tried to solve them on a computer, you actually know how difficult it is. So fluid mechanics is hard, right? It's not linear. Why is it not linear? Look at the second term in the continuity equation. Look at the second term in the Euler equation. The third term in the Euler equation. Those are nasty things to deal with. They introduce nonlinearity. So what we can do is we can solve these equations in a simple regime where I have a smooth background with small fluctuations on top of it. And hey, that's actually the problem we're interested in, because that looks a lot like our universe. So we're going to linearize. So what do we assume? We assume, for example, that rho is some constant plus a small fluctuation that in general could be a function of space and time. So we'll assume here that rho bar is just a constant for now. You know, I could have my velocities. So we'll denote the quantities here, rho bar, as the sort of zeroth order. This thing we'll call it first order. And this is a genuine expansion in the sense that delta rho, we're going to assume, is everywhere much, much less than rho bar. And when we say linear, that's what we mean. If delta rho becomes of order rho bar, then we're in the, quote, nonlinear regime. So that denotes the boundary between what we call linear and what we call nonlinear. We could assume that the velocities, you know, they just have in the background, and everything is just still. Everything is co-moving. So the velocities just have a first order term. And phi, you can see that the Poisson equation, if rho bar is constant, then there is no background Newtonian potential, or that's an arbitrary choice I can make, so I can set it to zero. It's only the variations in the Newtonian potential that matter. So the Newtonian potential itself is also just going to be made of a first order piece. Okay. So here are my assumptions. And now I can stick this set of assumptions, this ansatz, into those equations up there and see what I get. Okay, so what do I mean by linearize? So we can look at the continuity equation. And I will simply substitute in for rho, delta rho bar plus delta rho. And then I have the gradient of rho bar plus delta rho times delta v. And that's equal to 0. So now we can just expand this out. So the time derivative of rho bar is 0 by assumption, because I told you that that was just a constant. So here I get dt delta rho plus the gradient of, so I could pull the rho bar out. That's just a constant. Rho bar times the gradient of delta v, the divergence. Why am I saying gradient? Being silly today. Plus the gradient of delta rho times delta v, and that equals 0. So this term is first order because it has only one power of a small quantity. This term is first order because it has only one power of a small quantity. But this term is second order because I've got delta rho times delta v, so we're going to chuck that. So that's going to be small compared to the other two terms. And now I'm just left with dt delta rho plus rho bar times the divergence of delta v equals 0. And that is my linearized equation of motion. So now I can repeat that procedure for the rest of the equations that I have up there. And expand those out. And I'll let you fill in the steps during your tutorial, but here's what you can expect. So you can actually combine all the equations once you linearize them and define something called the sound speed, and that's just dp bar over d rho bar, so just a statement of how the pressure depends on the density. And in the case where I have an equation of state, that's just w. Okay, so this is the square of the sound speed in your medium. And combining the equations in the right way, so if you take a time derivative of the continuity equation and spatial derivative, I believe, of the Euler equation, then you will find the following. So I just get a second order equation, a wave-like equation for the density perturbation. Okay, so the next step is to go to Fourier space. So if we go to Fourier space, delta rho is a function of x and t. We can write as the integral d cubed k over 2 pi to the 3 halves. I'll try and stick to that convention for the 2 pi's, but don't kill me if it changes along the way by accident. Times delta rho is a function of k and t times e to the I k dot x. Okay, so we express this in Fourier space. We substitute it in. And now the del squared, of course, goes to negative k squared. And nothing else really interesting happens. So in the end, we get the second time derivative of delta rho, which is a function of k and t now, plus k squared times the speed of sound squared times delta rho minus 4 pi g Newton rho bar, all times delta rho equals 0. So that's kind of nice. Now for each momentum, I have the equation of an oscillator, right? And depending on what the value of this thing in here is, so we'll call this the frequency squared. So if I have a frequency squared that's bigger than zero, it looks like a harmonic oscillator. If I have a frequency squared that's less than zero, it looks like an upside down harmonic oscillator. And so here, of course, the solution is just delta rho is proportional to plus or minus I omega t. So if omega squared is bigger than zero, that's real. These are oscillatory. And if omega squared is less than zero, then omega is imaginary, and this is either exponentially growing or exponentially decaying. So the sign of omega squared crucially determines the behavior of these functions. And you can think about this physically as follows. So here I have this term. This came from pressure. So pressure wants to expand things out. It wants to make oscillations. It wants to make sound waves. This is gravity. Gravity wants to make structures collapse. It wants to make density fluctuations grow. It wants to grow density fluctuations. That means they collapse. And so we have this competition going on. And you can see that the competition, who wins, actually depends on what scale I'm looking at. So it crucially depends on the scale k. So where omega equals 0, where omega squared equals 0, the boundary between oscillations and exponentially growing or decaying solutions, I'll just write that here, oscillatory growing decaying. So omega squared equals 0 defines the boundary. And it also defines a scale. We call that scale the Jean scale. So we can just solve for where that equals 0. So k genes is equal to 4 pi g Newton rho bar over c squared. And I can turn that wave number into a physical scale, a wavelength. That's actually what we call the Jean scale, lambda j. That's 2 pi over k j. And square root. And so that's just the definition of the Jean scale. So in particular, if I have a wavelength that's larger than the Jean scale, then I get gravitational collapse. If I have a wavelength that's smaller than the Jean scale, I get oscillatory motion. So let's write that. So for lambda wavelengths bigger than the Jean scale, I get growth and decay. For lambda less than the Jean scale, I get oscillations. And what are those oscillations? Those are just sound waves. Okay. So you can see that depending on the scale I look at, I can either make something grow or I can make it oscillate. Now, why does it have to be a big scale? You can physically think of that because in order to get a lump of stuff to want to collapse, I have to have enough stuff around to gravitationally attract itself. It's really that simple. Okay, so long wavelength stuff wants to collapse and form structure. Short wavelength stuff does not. Okay, good. So that was the picture of fluctuations in that small little patch of my picture. So can I actually apply this to cosmology? Yep.
For this analysis to be valid, you need the Jean's length to be less, much less than the Hubble's scale and also the sound speeds?
Don't steal my punchline.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
So we're going to talk about when this is valid right now. So can we apply it to cosmology? But you've answered the question. It depends on what scale we're looking at. So the answer is no. Well, not if time scales, as you mentioned, approach something like 1 over the Hubble, and length scales approach something like 1 over Hubble. So we can ask, do the relevant time and length scales actually approach these values? So what is Hubble, right? H squared is 8 pi g Newton over 3 times rho bar, right? So that would be what we'd define as the background Hubble expansion. And you could see conveniently that something that looks a lot like that appears in the gene scale, right? It also appears in the frequency. So with that definition, lambda j looks something like square root of sound speed squared over Hubble squared. Okay, so that's like sound speed times H inverse. So here you can see that it really depends on what the sound speed is. So whether or not I can actually talk about growing modes that are of a wavelength that I can actually describe using Newtonian theory, it depends crucially on the sound speed. So the sound speed is equal to, sound speed squared is W, I told you, for some fluid that has a constant equation of state. So for matter, W is zero. So the sound speed is zero, and that means that the gene's wavelength is zero. So that's fine. If I have matter, we're fine. We're looking at wavelengths can collapse on all scales. So that's a funny property of matter, which is that collapse happens on all scales. Why? Because there's no pressure. There's nothing to prevent collapse. What about radiation? So for radiation, W is 1/3. So the sound speed is 1 over square root 3. And you can see now we've got a little bit of a problem because lambda genes is going to be sort of order H inverse over square root 3. And actually, if I include all the factors of 2 pi and stuff, then that's bigger than H inverse. So this is bad. So collapse of relativistic matter can't be described by Newton. So in answer to your question, for matter, it's kind of OK. For radiation, it's not. Now, there's one last thing to check, actually, which is, what is the time scale of collapse? Because both the length and the time scales have to be shorter than H inverse. Okay, so the typical time scale for collapse is just given by omega, right? And omega is, well, it depends on the wavelength a little bit, but let's look at matter. That was the thing we thought was most okay. And in that case, the sound speed is zero. So omega is roughly 4 pi g Newton times rho bar. But what is that? That is, in fact, nothing other than 3 halves times H inverse, right? or 3/2 times h. So the time scale, if I were to assign a time constant to collapse, remember delta rho is just proportional to e to the omega t in this case, where I guess this is imaginary. So let's just put absolute value omega t. So I can say that my time constant is just 1 over omega, and that's of order h inverse. So I'm actually in trouble. So I can't really describe all of the evolution. I can't really describe collapse on timescales that I'm allowed to talk about. Yeah?
Saying that omega is equal to that, whereas in the line above, you put omega squared is equal to that.
Yeah. It's because I forgot that. Thanks. Very good. So, right. So this is bad. So we can't use Newtonian theory on all time scales. But it turns out there's a middle ground fix, which is what you'll do in your tutorial, which is if you just do Newtonian gravity, but you assume that the fluid is expanding like it would in an expanding universe, it turns out that that's OK. So you can fix by adding expansion. Okay, so you'll explore that. But for radiation, and this is going to work, can fix by adding expansion, and that only really works for matter. For radiation, I need to be more careful. I actually need to do the full relativistic theory, which is, of course, why you're sitting in this room, because that's what we're going to do.
Zero. I guess that's sort of been a relativistic, or like CS equals zero, that's sort of a relativistic. It's so, like, if you do actual astrophysics, does that approximation, do you ever get to the point where you consider non-zero speed of sounds, or is it always?
No, so you never would. The reason being that we've neglected any kind of interaction between the gas. So real gas in astrophysical systems gets heated up, and you know, it can cool, and there's all sorts of other processes that go on that are not well described by just having a perfect non-interacting fluid. So this is really only good for really large cosmological distance scales, in a sense. It sort of works. So for example, you could use this time scale for collapse to, say, approximate how long it would take to make a star. I don't include cooling or anything like that. And you get some answer, and that's kind of reasonable. So it's an approximation. It's a reasonable approximation for cosmology. It's probably a bad approximation for most of astrophysics. Okay, so we are out of time. Any other questions? Okay, so in tutorial today, you are going to make that fix. So you're going to basically going to derive some more results here, and then add expansion, and then learn some stuff about how fluctuations grow. I'll tell you the answer. So if I have an expanding universe, fluctuations grow much more slowly than exponentially. They actually only grow like a power law. And that has important implications for structure formation in our universe, like the universe had to have fluctuations actually fairly large in the beginning in order to ever get nonlinear structure. So you'll see that. I'll review it tomorrow morning, and then we'll start with the fully relativistic case.